I gotta tell you, man, there is no place like home. The last few podcasts that I was doing for TIFF, where I was, you know, recording on a street corner, recording in a restaurant, they were fun and they were nice in their little impromptu kind of way. But I much prefer sitting at my desk with my drink and just hiding behind the comfort of my microphone.
You can almost liken that experience to going to see a movie in maybe a crappy cinema and then seeing something in the comfort of your own home. On Blu-ray. I can't say I know exactly what you're talking about, save for one impromptu interview I've made, but yes, I the tools are in your woodshed, I think things go a lot smoother.
Welcome to Wherever You Are. I'm Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to the 41st episode of the Matinee Cast. This is the official podcast of thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. And I'd like to thank everybody off the top for following my TIFF coverage, including Mark. Thank you. But we're back to the show as normal tonight, and we've got a guest. When it comes to rating films, I like to stare at my keyboard and hammer out whatever I can remember and ultimately rank the film on a feeling I get in my gut, but not today's guest. Today's returning guest has a beautiful mind. He has equations and formulas drawing cinematic conclusions with mathematic precision and accuracy that would make Stephen Hawking blush. Thus, when it comes time to talking about what he goes to see, you can be sure that pinpoint accuracy is at hand. Oh yeah, and he's also a great guy. We're back across the wire to Texas tonight. We're talking to the brains behind GoSeeTalk.com. Please welcome back to the Matinee Cast, Mr. Mark Ciafardini. How are you, sir?
Doing fantastic, Hatter. How are you tonight?
I am very, very well. I think this might be my first chance to actually address this. It amuses me that after 4 years of holding a pseudonym and just telling everybody, hey, you can call me by my given name, that nobody's doing it.
It's something that people have, it's so ingrained in their psyche that it's a knee-jerk response. You know, you talk about the dark of the matinee, it's Hatter.
Today in episode 40, we'll be discussing Moneyball. We'll be fielding some listener feedback and talking about our top five Brad Pitt scenes. But first, let's learn more about our guest. This is Know Your Enemy. On episode 20, last August, we learned that the first film that Mark had ever seen was Peter Pan. The last film he'd seen at the time was Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan. Two of the worst films he'd ever seen were Paul Blart Mall Cop and the Miley Cyrus epic The Last Song. The classic or essential he'd never seen was Vertigo. Any luck on that?
I did.
Attaboy. What'd you think?
Hitchcock is a master because you don't see things coming.
That's
and
it.
I was overly impressed with how the setup was. And well, I guess, can you claim that, you know, things you say now are still a spoiler to a movie like that?
No.
But the whole, the whole switch and, the scene and the bell tower at the end, I mean, wow.
And is
that about spellbinding?
Yeah, that is the stuff of legend. I am actually looking forward. I think I might have a chance in the next month or two to see that on a big screen for the first time. So here's hoping. And the film that Mark wished he'd made was The Rocketeer. And I think after seeing Joe Johnson's Captain America, that I got to say here, because that was very, very similar to some of the stuff in The Rocketeer, no?
I haven't seen it, which is, kind of... Give me the red carpet and I trip over my own feet.
That brings us, of course, to the second batch of five questions. And no, Mark, these are not written specifically for you.
Oh, great. Thanks for, I didn't want my ego to get the better of me on the air.
Well, Mark, tell me, what is a film you dig that nobody else does?
G.I. Joe.
Wow.
I'm not going to make any bones about it. I equate it to pure popcorn fun. And actually, I didn't even want to see it. It's very off-putting. When I first saw the trailer, I just said, accelerator suits? who is in their right mind? I'll give Stephen Sommers a benefit of the doubt 8 days a week, but come on, what's going on here? So I had to go see it because I recorded a podcast, and I ended up loving it. Not because it was good, but because I had so much fun with it. And, I equate equate it to a roller coaster, and I've always wanted to get this out there. You know, when you go to a theme park and you sit in a roller coaster car, you don't evaluate, well, turn one didn't happen fast enough, and the climax of the final run, you know, you don't look at something like that. You evaluate it as a whole, and if you walked away smiling, regardless of how crappy it was, then you can still say you had a good time. And that's why I dig it, and very few people do.
It's the kind of movie, I've had a few of them in the last year or so where I say, you know, I know it's not good, but I enjoyed it. You know, I like a film, kind of a similar film, The Losers. Did you see that one?
Yeah, with Idris Elba and Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I did not give it a good rating, and I could not tell somebody, you must go see this, it's really good. But I had a fun time. It was money well spent. I laughed. I like you said, it was the roller coaster. So if you wanna paint G.I. Joe with that brush, I cannot fault you one bit. Now, conversely, what's a film that everybody else seems to enjoy but you don't?
Scarface.
Okay.
I will go on record, and I've always wanted to go on record, so I'm glad you're giving me the soapbox for this.
No problem.
I loathe Scarface. Not to say it's terrible, but I think it's been hyped up to criminal proportions. I think, and I use the term criminally kind of funny because who are the stereotypes that love this movie? Kids in high school and everyone in the rap game. And, you know, that's probably painting too broad of a brushstroke, but
no, I think you got it.
And the thing is, I know a lot of people who watched it in high school, loved it in college, and still, they're married men and they have posters in the garage. But and people will give me crap for liking something like Big Trouble in Little China, one of my favorite movies of all times. But I just don't get the hype for Scarface because it does not live up to it. And I think I hate the hype more than the movie itself.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm not really a defender of Scarface. I like Scarface. I own a copy of Scarface. But you're right. It has kind of taken this place in pop culture legend that I'm not entirely sure it deserves. Now, it's kind of funny because I actually do like things about it still. I like Pacino's performance. He gets off some great lines, and I'm not even talking about first you get the money and then you get the women. I just, stuff like, there's the scene where he's screaming drunk in the restaurant and he goes like, you need people like me, you need to be able to say there's the bad guy. He just owns that scene. Now, you're right, it's played to death and it is very overhyped, so I'm not nearly going to twist your arm and, you know, tell you to watch it again, as I'm known to do. But that is one I have. I don't think I've heard that answer for this question, but I can, if somebody says to me, I know everybody loves Scarface, but I really don't, I can't argue with them.
Well, thank you for being on my side. I thought it was me against the world on that.
No, you're good. What is either the last film or just any film that made you cry?
I was trying to think of what I recently watched that did kind of get me. But then I just always fall back to sort of an obscure one, but it's Apollo 13.
Really?
Yeah. I remember seeing that when I was in high school. You know, I got it on VHS for Christmas, and I didn't know anything about the story. I knew nothing about the movie going in. It was just completely blind. And so you get to that point in the movie where they're entering the Earth's atmosphere, and I credit Ron Howard and especially James Horner for just the score. You know, you get in that the 3 minutes of blackness or the silence that the astronauts came into when they were re-entering the atmosphere. And if you don't know which way it's going to go, it really gets you on the edge of your seat. And when Tom Hanks, you know, when you hear his voice after the 3 minutes and James Horner's score just lifts you up. I mean, no matter how many times I watch it, I still think back to that time where I was just blown out of my chair. Just, you know, as a high school kid, you know, I wept. I mean, not, you know, like sobbing tears like,
no.
Nope. You know, it definitely gets you. Like,
that makes complete sense. And like you said, certainly that rising score in that moment is really, really what sets you over. Because I can close my eyes and I can imagine that music that plays up. And, you know, it's uncertain, right? Like, if it was the kind of spoilers for actual history coming up, if it was the kind of story for characters to actually die, that would be, you know, where they're gonna go. They're not gonna kill them off in the middle of the story, and they've come that far. In the movie of your life, who plays you?
Luke Wilson.
Okay, any reason?
I'd like to say Owen Wilson, but I'm not as zany. Luke always comes across as, you know, heartfelt, but still soft-spoken, and I think that's kind of, that kind of fits me. You know, there's a couple roles where I've watched him go, yeah, that's how I would react to in a situation. Forgive the fact that he was probably told to act a certain way in the script. It's just his deliveries. I see similarities in his persona.
Not bad, not bad. That's a different answer. Plus, of course, he's a Texan boy.
Yeah, that kind of helps.
And last but not least, what's the next film you're watching?
Margaret.
Can't say I've heard of it.
Okay, you wouldn't be alone in that. it's a movie about Anna Paquin, who witnesses a bus accident. It stars Mark Ruffalo, Anna Paquin, Jean Reno, Matt Damon, quite a few other actors.
Is this the one that sat on a shelf for like 3 years?
Yes.
Wow.
It was supposed to be released. I mean, I think Martin Scorsese had a hand in it. Sidney Pollack helped produce it. And it just kind of bounced around. And I think that it was too soon after 9/11 that people were claiming that it was an allegory to 9/11, the whole about, you know, if you witness something, but Anna Paquin doesn't tell the truth, and, you know, how many people's lives can be affected by not doing what is right. It just sat on the shelf, and recently a trailer came out about 2-3 months ago, and it's actually on a shameless plug here. It's on GoSeeTalk.com, but it, you watch it and you go, wait, that looks like a young Anna Paquin. And then you realize that, yeah, a lot of this was shot about 7 years ago. So, you know, young Matt Damon, young Anna, young Mark Ruffalo.
Wow.
And so I'm actually going to see a screener for it next week.
I will be very, very curious what you have, like how this holds up, how it plays. It's kind of going to be like a little bit of a look back, actually, because it's like it does have some younger cast members. Not only Anna Paquin, who's, you know, I'm using a younger sort of generously here, but Kieran Culkin is another person
who, that's right, yeah.
You know, and they've changed in 5 or 6 years. It looks like this was all produced back in 2005 or so, 2006.
Yeah.
You know, so to have it sitting on a shelf for a while is, it's kind of a daring move. So I'll definitely be curious to see what you make of it. Well, there we go. That's more about Mark, and now it's time to talk to you, or more specifically, it's your chance to come talk to me. Please talk to me. Won't you please talk to me? We can unlock this mystery. Come talk to me. Well, after last episode, because I had no clue what I was going to come up with after TIFF, I put out a question on Facebook and Twitter to talk to people about TV. TV, of course, is coming back now, and I don't really write a whole lot or podcast a whole lot about TV. I do like to watch TV. And I've noticed over time that movie stars are turning up more and more in TV, and not because they can't hack it as movie stars. It's kind of become, they make their own direction. So you look at people like right now, I'm not entirely sure what I think of the show, but Zooey Deschanel is on a TV show. And of course, Steve Buscemi is on a TV show. And it goes on and on and on. So my question to people was, which movie stars would you like to see on a TV show? I began with Andrew James, who hosts the Row 3 Cinecast, and I did an episode with them during TIFF. If you haven't heard, go over to row3.com and check that out, because that was a lot of fun to do. Andrew said he would like to see Phil Seymour Hoffman as a corrupt Chicago police officer, which I don't know about you, Mark, but that sounds like a badass idea to me.
After seeing him in Moneyball, he can play anything, but that's, yeah, right. I could see that happening.
Yeah, yep. He also went on to say, this actually amused me quite a bit, he said, Kate Blanchett works as a radio relay officer in a space station. She's the go-between from Earth and a distant civilization in another galaxy. She's in charge of keeping comms open and hears, and can manipulate if need be, all interaction between two factions. Further, this is how much time he had. She's the only character that we ever see on screen. We obviously hear all the radio transmissions, but she's the only one the audience interacts with. Andrew might just have taken the spot as my god. That is just a great idea. I don't know if it could ever work as a show. That actually sounds like a pretty badass movie. But to come up with all that as an answer is pretty good.
Wow. It's like buried in space.
Yeah, or source code.
Yeah, even better.
Yeah, but without the train. Scott from one of my favorite podcasts, Frankly, My Dear, he says that someone should give Anna Faris a talk show.
I'm just trying to imagine, you know, would it be a straight-up Oprah Winfrey talk show, or would she do something like the Jamie Kennedy experiment?
I think she'd probably do something not quite as snarky, but something in the line of Chelsea Lately.
Okay.
You know, something that did not at all take itself seriously.
Yeah, she's super animated. She could, you know, she has more talent than the entire SNL cast. But
there we go.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, me too. Big Daddy Courtney Small, who I hung around with a lot at TIFF, says Chris Tucker. Apparently, he's more tolerable in small doses. Is my imagination, or has Chris Tucker been gone a long time?
Way too long.
Yeah. So there we go. Put him on TV. Jess Rogers from Insight into Entertainment and the Real Insight podcast is wishing with a capital W because she says Leo DiCaprio should go back to his roots. Yeah, I don't think that's happening anytime soon. But if it did, believe me, I would tune in for sure.
Growing pains, the grown-up years.
On Twitter, my friend Beth suggested, I love this suggestion too, she suggested Christopher Walken as somebody's aloof and wacky neighbor in a sitcom.
Isn't that half of his roles?
The wacky, certainly, but not as like the neighbor that comes in. Basically, like Christopher Walken as Wilson on Home Improvement or as the Steve Urkel character. I don't care how bad the rest of the show is, I would watch it just for Walken.
You know, he saved Saturday Night Live.
Yes, he does. Yes, he has.
So, yeah, I could. Okay, I'm down with that, too.
Yep. And one more from Twitter. Joanna Arcieri, who's launched her own podcast. If you haven't listened yet, you should check that out. She suggested that Jennifer Aniston should go back to TV and star in something on Showtime. But she should not be any kind of cop. Those two thoughts don't exactly hinge for me, but thank you, Joanna. I think I'm in agreement because while the whole shtick of it didn't quite work for me, I did like Jennifer Aniston in Horrible Bosses. It's one of the few times I've seen Jennifer Aniston not play Jennifer Aniston, and I really like that. She's very meticulously crafted this image, which is fine, and it, you know, it's certainly what people pay to see. But she can do more. She's actually quite talented when she's given the right material. And I'm thinking about stuff like I watched The Good Girl a month or two ago where she plays something a little bit different. So, yeah, if they gave her something on Showtime, like not something quite like Dexter, but something like a Nurse Jackie, I think she could do some good stuff.
It reminds me of this this quote that I heard from, I don't know if you know who John Campia is, but he used to be the founder and editor of the movie blog when not every other person on the planet had a movie website. Mm-hmm. He said it was an acting coach or a teacher in acting school told him, he says, people have a problem seeing an actor or paying to see an actor when they're so used to seeing them for free. I understand what you mean. She broke her own mold, but you know, there were still ties to, you know, her usual bunch of mannerisms. It's tough for her to find a role that people can't just go.
That's Rachel Green, right? Now, what about you? Who's an actor that you'd like to see either come to TV or come back to TV?
The first one is Val Kilmer. Because the guy is immensely talented, but he's definitely faded into near obscurity due to all the direct-to-video movies he's made. And, you know, even if the movie doesn't star him, he's in it. You know, he'll take a 5-minute role, and he's just done so much so recently. If you were to go to any blockbuster in the past 2 years, you'd see him on almost every third shelf. Like,
right.
What is this Russian movie? You know, so he's got talent, but you know, I don't know if he's playing this, if he's doing the aloof Marlon Brando thing, but he needs to be more focused because he was great in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and I'd like to see something a little closer to, not exactly Gay Perry, but you know, something that shows people that he still has talent and some draw, and I think a TV show could do that.
Okay, and who's your other one?
Keanu Reeves.
Oh boy. Yeah, so basically you want to reclaim the 80s stars, the early 90s stars, and dust them off.
I just think it would be neat if you actually took the Johnny Rico or Johnny Utah thing and you revisited the same character but made a TV show out of it. Because and if you give me the floor for just a second, the thing, I love House. House and Justified are two of my favorite shows. And
cool.
The only reason I could probably warrant or stomach a Point Break TV show is because Bryan Singer's whole idea behind the House show is that in a movie, you only get 90 minutes, 120 minutes to flesh out a character and get an arc and, you know, get behind the people in the movie. He goes, with a TV show, if you do it right, you can follow these arcs, you know, up and down across a whole season, and you get a much more fulfilling point A to point B. And I was just thinking the other day when I read it, I go, you know, thanks to a big cue with your question, if they did something Point Break with Johnny Utah, I think it'd be neat to see him again. 80s notwithstanding, you know, I think that his character could stand up in any generation.
Well, for me, my answer would actually be quite different than yours, and far less plausible, because mine are two younger actors who are both kind of on the upward slant of their career. A guy in the form of Jeremy Renner. He's kind of quickly becoming one of those guys who anything he's in, I'm automatically interested. If you go back and watch something like 28 Weeks Later, he's awesome in it. You go back and watch something like North Country, he's awesome in it. And he's tending to play different guys every time around. And of course, you got Hurt Locker, which I'm a huge fan of as well. So I'd love to see him in something, obviously, because of the kind of actors he plays. He'd probably play, you know, some sort of a cop, or he might play some sort of a crook. The actress that I would like to see back on TV, because she, I think, has grown into a much different actress than she was when she was last on TV, is Michelle Williams. Likewise, she is an actress who anytime she's in a movie, I'm interested because of the roles she's picking. So if she chose to do a show, whatever it would happen to be or be about, you know, probably a drama, because most of her movies these days are heavier. I'd be really, really fascinated to see what she could do. I'd kind of like to see her play something damaged. Like, I'd like to see her in kind of a Breaking Bad type show.
Okay.
Just because her image right now, it's not like squeaky clean, but she tends to play sort of the ingenue, you know, or at least like the sympathetic role. So I'd like to see her play something that's a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for here? See, I took too much time off during TIFF and I'm losing vocabulary. I'd like to see her play something that's a little bit more ambiguous in terms of its morality.
I think that she would need something more sympathetic after Blue Valentine.
Yeah. Well, for next episode, I actually want you folks to help me out a little bit. Just this week, I went out and re-upped a DVD that I already own onto Blu-ray. And by and large, I've got my own theories regarding DVD buying Blu-rays that I already own on DVD. But I want to know what you folks think about it. Are you in favor of buying something that you already own on DVD all over again on Blu-ray? Do you have any rules as to how often you'll do it or what the price point has to be? Do you even buy anything anymore? Are you just streaming everything or downloading everything? But specifically, where it comes to DVD versus Blu-ray, let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, which you can find me, matinee_CA. That's it for Come Talk to Me. It's time for the new slang, and the new slang is Moneyball. So Moneyball was directed by Bennett Miller. It was written by Steve Zaillian and Aaron Sorkin and based on the book by Michael Lewis. It stars Brad Pitt, Jonah Hill, and Phil Seymour Hoffman. It is very roughly about Billy Beane, who is the general manager of the Oakland A's back, he still is actually, but specifically in the early part of the 2000s, and how he was forced to rethink the entire nature of how a baseball team is built. Mark, what did you think of Moneyball?
I liked it. I wasn't blown away, but there was a lot of heart to it. And I think that it, with it being, you know, autobiographical in nature, you take the book and you put Aaron Sorkin's fingers on that, and it becomes heartfelt and emotional right out of the box. I really enjoyed it, but it was, it's kind of tough to describe because it's not a comedy.
Nope.
And it's not a drama.
Sort of.
So it's, you know, it's got bits of both, but even that doesn't really describe it. I've been struggling to write my review. It's almost done. I don't want to give anything away, and I don't want to claim that it's something it's not, because I think that you watch the trailers and you go, oh, it's a guy rebuilding a franchise. Is it
right.
Major League? No. You see some flashbacks. Is it for love of the game?
No.
No. But I think that it's a story about a man's personal struggle to make a paradigm shift despite everyone in the world telling him that he's crazy. It's kind of like, you know, Warrior this year. It's kind of like every underdog movie where somebody tells you you can't do something, and it's the person setting out to do something, you know, that they believe is right. And I think that's the thing that you can really take away from it. It's a story about a personal struggle and going after what you believe in.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that aspect of it.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because for 2 weeks in a row now, going back to another film, which I'll get back to that some other time, but I find myself on the other side of the fence. I find that I'm looking at a movie that a lot of people whose opinion I really respect and who I'm not going to say they're wrong are really, really effusing over a film. And I'm sitting there going, eh. The other film, I might as well get it out. The other film that happened with is Drive, and I'm not going to get off onto that tangent because it's a whole other conversation. But Moneyball is that film. Now, I actually saw this just before TIFF began, like just days before TIFF started. So I was in the mindset already of the fall film, and this is a movie I was looking forward to. And being a big baseball fan, I am very, very versed in what Moneyball is and what the concept is and how it changed the game. And when I looked at all the pieces on the board, when I looked at Bennett Miller directing it and specifically at Steve Zaillian and Aaron Sorkin writing it, I thought, this film has a lot of potential because it's taking kind of a barometrics of how you build something, basically changing it completely. Like you are completely spitting in the face of 100 years of sports architecture and saying, we can do this differently and get just as good a result. But for some reason, I found the end result lacking. And I mean this as a baseball fan and as a movie fan. And I did already say this on the Row 3 Cinecast. As a baseball fan and as a movie fan, I left Moneyball with this empty feeling that something didn't quite land. And it's been nagging me for like 3 weeks now since I saw it. But it didn't quite do it for me.
Okay. I can really see where you're coming from. Because I came out of the movie enjoying the ride. I mean, it's more than a point A to point B.
Oh, yeah.
It's about, again, it's about one person's personal struggle. But I think that the movie, for what it tried to do, it could have done it in a lot less than 133 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
I felt that it was stretched, and the things that were put in it, like the, you know, the family troubles, the relationships, the flashbacks, those things might have all worked well. They were good in theory, but I think that trying to go for too much heart bogged the movie down. And I think at the end of it, I agree with you. You left going, yeah, this didn't all fit together that well.
Yeah.
I liked part of it. You know, I don't know. I'm not going to compare this to G.I. Joe. The roller coaster thing kind of comes again. It's like, I liked the ride, but it could have been more fleshed out. And I think that it could have been done effectively if it was shorter and it was streamlined.
I should have asked this before, but are you a baseball fan?
Not in the least.
Okay, so then actually you're who I want to talk to. Were you following along with what they, like, when they set out to change the game, and they set out to do something different in terms of how they would score runs and how they would win games. Were you following all of that?
Following it like it attention was, or like understanding what they talked about?
Both.
In theory, I understood what they were going for. When there was that one conversation in the room, in the I guess in the basement, where they're all talking about, it's like, well, why are you going to do this? And he points to Jonah Hill. He's like, because he gets on base.
Right.
And they later, they equate what he's trying to do to just bean counting. And like, you know, like you said, and like they even say in the movie, you hear some voiceovers beyond the people kind of screaming in Brad Pitt's face. You know, you can't just put economics into this. You can't stand in the, you know, throw something in the face of 150 or 100 years of, you know, scouting. You know, we have instincts, we have experience. Like, you know, there's more to it than just, you know, numbers.
Right. So, but the funny thing is that as it happened, that actually worked. And basically what he did was they started sitting down and they started saying, you know what, there's more to this game than just hitting home runs, getting base hits, and knocking players in. Sometimes it's a matter of the fact that you've got two or three guys on and you've got the right turkey at the plate who can just drive one guy in, and that sometimes that's all you need. It is actually quite a revolutionary idea. But I was sitting next to a friend of ours, and I don't know that she's a big baseball fan, but if I were to bet money, I don't think she got what they were trying to do. Basically, if this was a heist and they were setting out how they were going to rip off the casino, I don't think they explained the plan very well, and that was where this really fell short. Because Moneyball, in its essence, is actually a really, really big revolution in terms of baseball and in terms of how runs were scored. And I thought that Jonah Hill as Peter, I thought him explaining that, and certainly Brad as Billy Bean buying it, I thought that part was kind of given the short shift so that we could watch Billy Bean stare off into the distance for the 16th time.
So, Aaron Sorkin was behind Facebook,
the
social network. And so maybe if you're asking people who don't know baseball very well or can comprehend what the idea behind Moneyball was, do you think that they did enough explanation in Facebook of how they came up with the formulas?
It might also just be that I found the human drama in Social Network a little bit more interesting than the human drama in Moneyball. Because beyond Billy Bean and Art Howe hoping that they keep their jobs, it doesn't seem like the human drama is here quite as much as it is in something like Social Network. Let's talk about Pitt's performance for a second. What did you think of Brad Pitt in this movie?
You know, it's funny. Brad Pitt is good at reacting. Brad Pitt doesn't drive many scenes, at least in, you know, the movies that I like of his. He's very good at playing second fiddle. He plays aloof in this movie kind of well, but not stereotypically aloof.
Right.
He delivered the lines, and that was really funny what you said about him staring off for the 16th time. That was pretty good. I mean, it takes a lot of balls for Billy Bean to do what he did. So I think that what Brad Pitt was doing a lot of introspective acting.
You know, yeah.
It's almost, and when you talked about drive a second ago, it's almost like what Ryan Gosling did. It's like there's, you know, it's minimal, and he's just kind of giving stuff on the surface, but it's what's going on under the surface that I think people might be reading into. I don't think he's actor quality in this performance, and it was, I mean, I think for the most part, this was almost like a TV, made-for-TV movie. It didn't come across as like a Hollywood blockbuster. It didn't come across as something as, you know, as dramatic as The Social Network.
It's kind of funny because I guess the reason why I'm perplexed is that it didn't seem like Brad Pitt did anything special here, which is really, really strange. Like, you know, and don't get me wrong, Billy Bean is no Brad Pitt. Like, he had to dial it down. He had to be introspective. He had to be very, very everyman to really nail it, because baseball GMs are not rock stars. It's just that simple. They're very ordinary looking guys. They carry themselves in a very certain type of way. They tend not to be very outlandish when they're in front of a microphone, and they are in front of a microphone quite a bit. So to see Pitt really dial it down and play not a schlub, but just play an average Joe, kind of seemed a little weird, because you look back over some of his recent roles, you look back at him in Inglourious Basterds, you look back at him in Burn After Reading, the Oceans movie, Jesse James, he tends to play very, very distinct characters. So to see him play very straight-laced, it's not like it was a stretch. To me, it just seemed like, why cast Brad Pitt in that role? You didn't need him.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's I guess like it's if my ambivalence of this movie is not coming through, it's a film I'm not going to slam it. I'm not going to say that it's terrible. I just wanted a lot more from it, and it saddens me, because I watch, it's been all over the TV in terms of trailers and commercials and whatnot over the last few weeks. And I watch those ads, and baby, they make this thing look so good. They make this film look punchy and really witty and snappy, and it just, for me, the pace was just off. Feel bad saying that, but I got nothing else.
It's not Brad Pitt in this movie, and when you talk about dialing it down, did you notice how many scenes he was walking through the movie, and kind of like the Ocean's movies, he was eating something and had stains on his shirt? I don't know if you noticed.
Yeah.
That.
Oh no, I noticed. Yeah, he's walking around with a paper cup, and he's chewing on spit. He's working on chewing tobacco, and he's spitting it into the cup.
Like you said, it didn't need to be him, but but I didn't. Not that he was glamorous. It just I didn't mind him in the role, but it didn't do anything for him. It's kind of like, well, it really pains me to say it was a paycheck, but I mean, if he puts his money into the movie, it's not like he's looking for a paycheck, but. No. I don't know. It could have been Keanu Reeves. It could have been Kevin Costner. It could have been any everyman actor. And that's not to put any of them or even Brad Pitt down for what he did, but true. I was looking for more.
If we are going to take one souvenir away from Moneyball, the one thing that you thought was really cool that you would like to take with you and keep with you, what would be your souvenir from Moneyball?
I think it's the one where he and Jonah Hill were negotiating a trade for three players, and Brad Pitt was, and I really credit the movie, and I think maybe it's Michael Lewis who wrote the book. I credit the book more to that, is showing what a lot of people, even if they're baseball fans, don't get to see. Okay, well, I want this one player. Well, how much, what kind of kicker are you going to give me? Well, I don't know. Well, I'll call you back in 5 minutes. Susie, get the Indians up.
Yeah.
Just that sequence, I think that It didn't make the movie, but that's what I really found enjoyable. It's scenes like that, that if you're not a fan, or even if you are a fan and you don't know what was behind closed doors, it was really nice to see.
It sure was. I'm in agreement. That was a great scene. It was a great. I think that's the thing. I wanted more of that in the film, and we didn't get much of that. Well, if I've got a souvenir from this film. Not to give too much away, but there's a conversation at the end of the film between Jonah Hill and Brad Pitt in front of a video monitor. Jonah Hill shows, the Peter Brand character shows Billy Bean something and makes an analogy. And it's a beautiful little sight, and it's a great analogy. And I loved it, actually. It was the one thing that kind of left me with a smile on my face with this film. But on a scale of 1 to 4, Mark of Go See Talk, what do we give Moneyball?
A solid 3. I'm not going to knock it for things that weren't there. I'm just going to try to praise what I liked about it and what was there.
I'm going down to a 2, which, if you know anything about my site and my ratings, that is my lingo for I didn't care for it, but you very well might. There, as I said, there were things that I wanted out of it that it didn't give me. It's not completely the movie's fault. There are some technical glitches that I think could have used some tweaks, but what can I say? Moneyball, 2 out of 4 for me, 3 out of 4 for Mark, and maybe we're both crazy. Maybe it's a 4, maybe it's a 1. Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, twitter.com/matinee_ca, or Facebook. Well, that's Moneyball. Let's get to top 5. This is the best of you. It's someone getting the best, the best, the best. Well, of course, everybody loves a top five, and so I was told after a recent blog post, so we're going to do one, and do one a little bit different than what I'm used to around here, and that is we're going to talk about one specific actor. Of course, in this case, it's Brad Pitt, who has, over the last 25 years or so, created some of the more iconic roles on the silver screen. So we're going to rhyme off not his best parts and not his best films. We're actually going to talk specifically about his best scenes. And there were quite a bit to choose from. But why don't you get us started off, Mark? What was your first Brad Pitt scene that you really dig?
One of my favorite movies of all time is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. There's a couple scenes where Brad interacts with Tilda Swinton. And it really gets the movie grounded because the beginning of the movie, it's, you know, I think as cinephiles, we look at scenes that are even the slightest bit off as far as, you know, because so much of the movie was almost CG, and it kind of takes you out of the movie. But as great as the CG was, nothing really started to sell Brad Pitt and his reactions, because he's really good at reacting to situations.
Especially in this movie.
And that's kind of the way the movie was geared, because it was with him in reverse. So when he's talking to Tilda, there are very sweet moments. Benjamin Button is learning so much just by being in a room with Tilda, who is, you know, expelling all this worldly knowledge. And he may be playing it like he's aloof, but it's really more of he's just taking it in, because he's just about maybe 18, 21. I forget, you know, what age that was when he was meeting her and working on that ship. But he was just completely mesmerized with somebody telling him all the things that he didn't know.
Well, it's also because he's really shy in these scenes, right? Like, you think back to being an 18-year-old, and certainly if you're an 18-year-old in the presence of an older woman who's extolling this worldly knowledge, you're just going to shut up and try not to piss your pants, basically. And that's exactly what he's doing very subtly.
Yeah, very, very true, very true. Like, the one point where they meet each other for probably the third time, and she's all dressed to the nines, and he goes, I'm not dressed up. And it, you know, it's him just being honest, being completely caught off guard. But I mean, he's so taken to her just because she's everything he's never known. Everything's so new to him, but it's so funny to see it on the flip side, because he looks so much older, but he's really under all the layers of skin, and, you know, based on the backwards way he aged, I mean, he's just out of his teens. So yeah. I thought they were really sweet scenes, and he just did a good job reacting to everything.
Absolutely. Well, you are certainly on the right show, because as many people know by now, I am a defender of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which I think is unfairly slammed amongst many. My first scene, when I'm thinking about the top five Brad Pitt scenes, is the one that was really his coming out party. And I'm thinking of 1991 Thelma and Louise, and his scene in the motel room with Gina Davis, when he's basically giving a dry run of a holdup, and he's, you know, brandishing that hair dryer with aplomb, and he's got that cowboy hat on, and his abs are just all over the place. And if ever there was a how-to on how to break into Hollywood and become a star, I think this scene is it.
Well, I really wish I could agree with you on that, but I haven't seen Thelma.
Oh, my goodness. This podcast is over. Thank you for listening.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for having me. We were go see talk.com.
First of all, okay, Thelma and Louise has actually aged very, very well. I saw it on a big screen again back in June, and it's got a moment or two of early 90s-ness, but it still looks and sounds fantastic. And basically, he'd done a few smaller parts by this point in some really crap movies and some crap TV shows. He was actually on Growing Pains. Speaking of that show, that's twice in one episode. But this was really his breakout. Like, not long after this, he would do A River Runs Through It in California and True Romance. But he kind of got it all captured in a bottle for this film. He's really exuberant. He's really cool. Of course, he's got the older woman again, Gina Davis just fawning all over him. And, you know, even just as a guy, you're like, that is one cool dude. So that movie, he's awesome in it. That scene, he just owns. And where Brad Pitt's story is concerned, usually that's the starting point. And now you have some homework to do. Watch Thelma and Louise at some point and write about it. But what's your next scene for where Brad Pitt is concerned?
It's got to be Snatch. the first time we meet Mickey, where Jason Statham is doing the narration, and you know, Mickey comes out from behind a truck to meet Stephen Graham and Jason Statham, and it's like, why is he, you know, tying his belt? Oh, because he was taking a crap behind a truck. It's like, okay, definitely get you on the right pace of who this Mickey is. And you know, it's like Jason Statham says in the narration, is like, well, it's not Irish, it's not English, it's pikey. And so, you know, when he goes into his gibberish, and it's, you know, a lot of people can't understand it, but, you know, when you start to listen to it again, it's like there's a lot of character in that role. And I think that Brad does so much with it, especially when you see somebody of his stature. You know, he was hot back then as far as, you know, his career and everything. He was, you know, on fire. And then to see him do this grungy underground gangster British movie, you know, it's like, wait a second, I thought your star was on the rise. What, you know, what are you doing in this? So, I mean, just, you know, his intelligible speak, you know, the part when he's like, are you a boxer? You look like a boxer. It was on, you know, just all his lines. But just that first distinguishing scene where you're taken aback and you don't realize it's Brad Pitt. I think that's what an actor does best, is when you don't see the actor in the role.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, you know, it's funny. I know I've seen Snatch too many times when I can understand Mickey pretty damn well.
You like dags?
Yeah. What?
Yeah. I like dags. Yeah.
Got a pair of damn shoes.
And so it's like, I understood what he was saying.
That was the thing. I got most of it, but as I watched it a few more times, I was getting more and more of it, to now is the point where it doesn't even faze me. But yeah, you're right. When the first time you see him, he's got that god-awful hat. He's wearing clothes that look like he pulled him out of a Goodwill bin. And it is not movie star Brad Pitt by any stretch. That was a badass... you know, that's right up there with Thelma and Louise for, you know, the introduction to Brad Pitt in a movie, for sure. Well, my next one is a little bit more dramatic and a little bit more subdued. My next one comes from Babel back in 2006. Did you see that one?
Strike two, Hatter.
I'm doing great. Basically, without going too far into this, he's a well-to-do American, and he's traveling with his wife, who's also played by Cate Blanchett in this movie. He's traveling with her in Morocco, and something happens to her while she's gone, and basically they're in a situation where they need diplomatic help, without kind of getting into too far. They're off in the middle of nowhere. They're the furthest possible way you can get away from anything resembling an embassy, and they need help in a big old hurry. When the situation resolves itself, he finally gets a minute or two to call home, and they're a married couple. They've got two kids back at home. In this scene, it's the simplest scene. He's on a payphone in a hospital in Morocco, and he's all by himself in this corridor. And, you know, in the movies, we're hearing the other side of the conversation. A lot of the times the actors are not. Who knows what's being told to them at the time? Sometimes there's another actor on the other end of the phone telling them the dialogue. Not always, but sometimes. I don't know what Brad was being told at this time. He might have been hearing what he needed to hear. But his reaction in this scene is the stuff of legend. It is really, really fantastic. It was kind of, I almost want to say it was the first time we saw this out of him. He kind of grew up with this film around 2006. It was sort of when he went from taking the cool parts and the edgy parts to taking the heavier parts. And it's a really, really cool scene. So I'd say check out Babel, first of all, because it is pretty good. Although I know people aren't fussed about it, but do check it out. And wait for this scene at the end, because it'll really kind of show you something different out of Brad Pitt that we're not always used to. But since you haven't seen it, that's about all I can say about it. So what's your next scene for Brad Pitt?
Going from what you said about what you're not used to seeing to what you're used to seeing, I'm going to go with Mr. and Mrs. Smith. It's a little more popcorny, a little more trite Brad Pitt, but the part where he and Angelina Jolie have just discovered that they were each other's target.
Yep.
And they've just come back to the dinner table.
Spoilers for Mr. and Mrs. Smith, by the way.
Oh, geez.
It's a joke to me. I mean, it's 6 years old. If you didn't know, I have no mercy, but I feel like a shithead if I don't say it.
The funny thing is you see them both respectively in, you know, both angles of their own individual spy game. And they're, you know, they're top drawer, untouchable talent. But then when you see them in the same room, you know, there's this uneasy tension. And, you know, as smooth and as sly as you saw Brad Pitt in this poker scene, to see him come home and be intimidated by his wife is actually kind of, it's really neat. I don't think the neat is a really great, you know, critic term, but I'm not a critic, but just to see him go from, you know, like a 180, being really confident, and then going, oh my gosh, is my wife poisoning my drink? What did she put on this steak? You know, I've just put salt on my steak. Is this poison in the salt? So there's this whole paranoia that's developing, and it's so underplayed, but he's struggling with confidence and paranoia at the same time. And then the point where, you know, the other shoe drops, or should I say the bottle drops.
Yeah.
And then, you know, everyone comes out and is revealed to be a spy. And it's just that one scene where he starts to show that he doesn't have everything under control. It's a really good scene.
The one that I love, that is an awesome scene, first of all. And I actually think that's kind of an underrated movie. It got sidetracked by all of the brouhaha surrounding him and Jolie and Jennifer Aniston at the time. But I actually think that movie is very, very underrated. The scene that I love in that film is the scene in the they're in a minivan in a car chase. And along with the fact that it's a great car chase, they're hashing out a whole bunch of lies and truths about their marriage. That, for me, is one of the best scenes in the film. Just because you have the two things going on at the same time, and it really made for a great little A great little dichotomy, basically. Definitely an awesome title for sure, and an awesome scene. Well, my next scene comes from not exactly his greatest film, but certainly one of his best performances. My next scene comes from Burn After Reading. Have you seen this one?
Oh, I have.
All right.
This will be a, let's just call this a base hit. It's not a home run for me by any means.
Oh, no, exactly. This, but for all involved, for George Clooney, for Francis McDormand, for Tilda Swinton, and certainly for the Coen brothers, this is not their best work. But there is some funny, funny shit going on in this movie. And the crowning glory for me is the scene where Brad Pitt as Chad Feldheimer calls John Malkovich, our protagonist Osborne Cox, and basically tries to extort him for this CD that he's found. And he calls him on the phone, and he goes, I would like to talk to you about the security of your shit. And of course, this is after he looks ridiculous in this film. His hair is feathered. It looks like it's got a bad bit of like spray in frosting going on. He's constantly wearing this sports apparel, and he always feels like he's always playing it like he's had about two Red Bulls too many. So even like when he walks into this scene, he's doing those like fist pumps. And he has this phone call.
Hello. Osborne Cox.
Yes. Who is this?
Is this Osborne Cox?
Who is this? What time is it? Who are you?
I'm a good Samaritan. I'm sorry I'm calling at such an hour, but I thought you might be worried.
Worried?
About the security of your shit.
What on earth are you talking about? Who am I speaking to?
Your files, the documents. I know these documents are sensitive, but I am perfectly willing to give back to you your sensitive shit, you know, at a time of your choosing.
What documents are you talking about?
Osborne Cox?
Hello, it's Osborne Cox. Who the fuck are you?
There. You're not used to hearing Brad Pitt act that dumb, act that dorky, and certainly act that over the top. So even though it is not really that great a film, that scene for me is one of the best Brad Pitt scenes you'll ever find.
Yeah, I think the thing that made me upset about that movie is that it was misrepresented. I think that the trailer industry has a notorious track record of cherry picking so many scenes to make you think that a movie is something that's not. And I expected a lot more of Brad Pitt being that over the top, sort of a Zach Morris on speed. I'll give you props to that, putting him in that position.
Thank you. What's your next one? We're up to your number two here.
It's Ocean's 11. And I think that, you know, it might sound like a broken record at this point, but, you know, Brad Pitt, he's just good at being reactive to situations. And, you know, this is probably one of his most, well, flamboyant is the wrong word, but, you know, he is the star in this movie. But still, he doesn't lead many conversations. And my number two is a scene where he doesn't say a single thing. It's where they've almost got their entire crew together. He and George Clooney are at some bar. And George Clooney and, you know, Brad Pitt has his head down, you know, leaning on his crossed arms. And George Clooney goes, okay, we got 10. 10 is enough. You think we need one more? You think we need one more? All right, we'll get one more. The only thing Brad Pitt does is blink at the very end of that. And I think that's just... It so describes their chemistry in the movie. It's you know, it's what great actors do. You do so much with less. And it was tough for me to number all of these, but, you know, going through it, I really like, because I saw that for early in my film career, or my film watching days. I really enjoy that scene.
Yeah, you know it's funny. I don't know why, but just I think one or two scenes before that moment. The bit that I love is when they're at the circus and they're going to get the amazing Yan.
Uh-huh.
And
little Chinese guy?
Yeah, exactly. Which one's the amazing Yan? The little Chinese guy. And it flips to a shot. There's like 16 little Chinese guys. But he says it so incredulously, and then he takes a drink like out of like a, you know, a fast food soda cup.
Uh-huh.
That's the part that for me just kills me, is that he's like, you know, well, of course, that's who the amazing Yan is. The thing I always love about Ocean's 11 is the little touch that Rusty is always eating.
Yeah.
Do you know why?
Not a clue.
Okay. Pitt came up with this when they were basically mapping out their characters. He figured, and I think rightfully so, that Rusty is the kind of guy who is who's basically always working on something. So because of that, he doesn't really have time to stop and eat. So he's constantly just eating as he goes.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, I do love the fact that that Rusty's always eating, and that, you know, that's, I think, one of the only scenes where he doesn't have food in his hands of some sort. Well, my number two will actually dovetail into your number one, but I think we can both agree that his most iconic part is by far Tyler Durden in Fight Club. And that's a movie that's near and dear to my heart. It's one of my all-time favorites. I'm a huge fan of the book. You can really kind of pick and choose your Tyler Durden moments. But for me, the quintessential Tyler Durden moment happens just shy of halfway through the film, where he's giving a pep talk to the collected Fight Club.
I see in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential, and I see it squandered. God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. We're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war, No Great Depression. Our Great War is a spiritual war. Our Great Depression is our lives. We've all been raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We're slowly learning that fact. We're very, very pissed off.
We're the lost generation of history. We have no Great War, no Great Depression. The ironic part, of course, now being that it's 10 years later and we kind of have both. The way he just moves with confidence through the crowd, the way he delivers these lines as only he can. It's a great monologue at the right moment, delivered beautifully by Brad Pitt.
That's a really good one. Yeah, I was trying to figure out what my number one was, that was one of the ones that I was considering. I'm glad you said that. So at least it gets, you know, some presence on
exactly
the podcast.
But speaking of your number one, let's listen to a little bit of it.
Look at your hand. The first soap was made from the ashes of heroes, like the first monkey shot into space. Without pain, without sacrifice, we would have nothing.
I tried not to think of the word serum or flesh.
Stop it! This is your pain. This is your burning hand. It's right here.
I'm going to my cave. I'm going to my cave. I'm going to find my power handle.
No! Don't deal with it the way those dead people do. Come on!
I get the point of that.
No, what you're feeling is premature enlightenment. Moment of your life, man, and you're off somewhere miserable.
I am not.
Shut up. Our fathers were our models for God. If our fathers bailed, what does that tell you about God?
No,
listen to me. You have to consider the possibility that God does not like you, never wanted you. In all probability, he hates you. This is not the worst thing that can happen.
It isn't.
We don't need him.
We don't. I agree. I agree.
Fuck damnation, man. Fuck redemption. We are God's unwanted children. So be it. Listen, you can run water over your hand to make it worse, or look at me, or you can use vinegar to neutralize the burn.
Please let me have it, please.
First, you have to give up. First, you have to know, not fear, know that someday you're gonna die.
You don't know how this feels.
It's only after we've lost everything that we're free to do anything.
So tell people why you chose this one.
Well, it's funny. I didn't like Fight Club the first time I saw it.
Blasphemy.
Yeah, well, when I say first time...
That's Mark at ghostlytalk.com. I've been...
exactly. Well, thank you and goodbye. No, when I say the first time I saw it, it's not to say the time I saw it or when I saw it. No, I've seen it about 5-6 times, and it just, you know, like Michael Keaton says in Beetlejuice, he goes, it gets better every time I see it. But what I like about the movie is the movie transitions from Edward Norton to being about Brad Pitt's character at that one point in time. He owns it. Everything in Brad Pitt's career has been about him being second fiddle to somebody, or even if he was a starring role, it was him not really getting his chance to do everything that he wanted with the role. It was here that he really just said, this is my movie, and he does it. And it comes across so impacting, and every time you see it, it becomes more. You find something deeper in his inflections. You find something more to take away from it. And it really, I mean, hey, if I could put that all on a bumper sticker, I would buy it and give it to all my friends.
Of course, being the fan I am, you know, I was happy that, like you said, I was happy that you got this one in because... it gave me a chance to pick something else. Now, he's telling you all of this and he's leading you somewhere because he wants you to understand something. And even though what he's doing is complete lunacy at the time, it takes you a second. You're like, I understand. He's nuts, but he's nuts in a not so nutty way.
Yeah, especially that part when he's like, oh, you want to reach for the water. No, don't you realize that water's not going to neutralize the acid?
That's
you
right.
Know? Like, yeah. He's one step ahead of... You know, Ed Norton, who is in fact one step just ahead of himself, since it's all internal. And I mean, it's a great, great movie. It gets better.
Well, my number one, I think it exemplifies a lot of what's best about Brad Pitt, and it is the mission speech from Inglourious Basterds. It is the I am Lieutenant Aldo Raine, and I'm, you know, looking for 8 soldiers, 8 Jewish American soldiers. He, in just absolute over-the-top hamminess, lays out the entire movie. You know, this is a film that starts off with an absolute barn burner of an opening scene where you get Christoph Waltz showing you exactly what you're in for. Because he just, you know, Christoph Waltz owns that first scene in the farmhouse. And, you know, you get your credits and happy days, and then you've got to go and follow that. And how do you follow that? Well, you follow that by playing it absolutely campy, absolutely hammy, and Brad Pitt does that. And he brings kind of the more, he brings the zany part. This is not the Babel scene. This is probably the furthest thing you can get from the Babel scene. This is closer to the burn after reading. This is closer to him in Snatch. This is him just eating it up, but still being so damn cool as he does it.
I agree. 100%. Yeah. I toyed with putting something from Inglourious, but I think the only thing I could really come up with was, you know, the end part where he's, you know, he's like, I'll disappear, I'll go away. You know, and he's like, no. That's
the problem, yeah.
Of course, I butchered the line. I haven't seen it in a while, but yeah.
and it's just, it's as I say, it's Brad Pitt, if nothing else, he has played some fantastic characters from, you know, and even guys that we didn't really talk about in the show, guys like Jeffrey Goines in 12 Monkeys and Detective Mills in Seven. He's played some just fantastic characters, had some fantastic scenes. And this is one of those moments where he is just given a few pages of dialogue to deliver, and he owns every single word.
Couldn't have said it better myself, right?
There we go. Well, that is it for this matinee cast and all of its Brad Pitt glory. Come on back for the Thanksgiving show on October 10th, Canadian Thanksgiving. We'll be talking about Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie 50-50. Mark's badassery online can be found at goseetalk.com. Do you have anything coming up soon for people to look forward to?
Going to be seeing Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, Warhorse, Ides of March.
Nice.
And Margaret, like I mentioned. Luckily I get to attend a couple, and Machine Gun Preacher, I get to attend a couple screenings ahead of time, so it's going to give me a lot more exposure than I expected this year, so should be finishing the year very strong with some hottest movies yet to see.
Soak it up, man. And if people want to follow you on Twitter, where can they find you?
We are at Go See Talk. Very easy, just like our website. And Facebook the same.
Very nice. Well, my blog, of course, is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find episodes at thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on mypodcast.com, Blueberry, and the iTunes Music Store. They're all free. They all give you ways to subscribe and find out when new episodes drop. I love feedback, so if you have any thoughts on Moneyball, Brad Pitt, or the whole upgrading DVDs to Blu-ray debacle, let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Or the comment section of the blog. Any last thoughts, buddy?
I'll say thanks for listening, and thank you, Hatter/Ryan/awesomeness, for having me again.
Anytime, man. I'll try not to make over a year go by before I get you back on this thing.
I'll hold you to it.
All right. Well, for Mark, I'm Ryan McNeil, and we'll see you at the matinee.
You will find me in the matinee, the dark of the matinee.